From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in January when Governor Andrew Cuomo announced his plan to legalize and tax recreational marijuana in New York State. Specifically, the proposal calls for three separate taxes on cannabis, which would be applied at the cultivation and wholesale stages, an opt-out clause for counties and cities that would like to ban the sale of the drug in their communities, and the creation of a new state office, the Office of Cannabis Management, to regulate the drug and to review and seal past convictions for people charged with its possession. If the plan is made into law, legal sales of recreational cannabis could begin by April 1st of next year, 2020. So back to the debate. Supporters of the governor's plan say legalizing the drug is a social and racial justice issue, saying that arrests have unfairly targeted communities of color in the past. And they say it could be an economic boon for the state, bringing in an estimated $300 million in tax revenue each year. Critics of the plan, which include many members of law enforcement, say that legalizing recreational marijuana could impact traffic safety and impose added costs to police departments. They also express concerns over how access to marijuana could lead to other forms of drug use. There's conflicting research on that. Well, this hour we sit down with representatives on both sides of this debate. Should marijuana, should cannabis, whatever, however you want to call it today, you want to legalize it in New York State? And if it does become legal, how should it be regulated? Our guests will discuss those questions and more. Joining us in studio, Chief Patrick Phelan of the Greece Police Department and a board member of the New York Association of Chiefs of Police. Chief Phelan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
Also with us is Sheriff Tom Doherty of Livingston County. Sheriff, welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jason Klimek, who is a legal advisor for Rock Normal. He's an attorney with Boyle & Code. Jason, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Steve VandeWall is deputy chief of Rock Normal. That's the Rochester chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Steve, welcome to you as well.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
You've been calling for this for quite some time now. Are you happy with what you've seen the governor propose here?
Considering, you know, we were initially pushing for a piece of legislation called the MRTA, which was written by Senator Liz Krueger and co-sponsored by Crystal People Stokes, and that was a piece of legislation that we were advocating in full. The CRTA, which is the Cannabis Regulation and Taxation Act, which is a piece of legislation introduced by the executive branch, is a piece that we really were only about 50% satisfied with because it didn't really address the things like, you know, social justice that were really at the forefront of our advocacy. But in the amendment process, we are getting much closer to a more sound piece of legislation.
All right. So let me ask the members of law enforcement here who have different views on this. Chief Phelan, I'll start with you. What do you make of what the governor has proposed, and what concerns do you have?
Well, the Chiefs Association of Law Enforcement has a variety of concerns. Probably the most serious one is the threat to traffic safety. States that have legalized marijuana have seen increases in traffic fatalities that are related to people driving under the influence of marijuana, and that's probably our primary concern.
Okay. Other concerns you have that come to the top of mind for you?
Well, you know, the I've spoken to law enforcement in California and Colorado, mm-hmm. and what they have seen is an increase in the black market when you do legalize marijuana, because there's a decreased danger in the possession and the transportation of the product. So actually, legalization leads to an enhancement of black market marijuana and transportation out of the state for sale in other states. With that, along with that black market, will come the obvious criminal aspects and violence that comes with the drug trafficking.
Okay, I suspect Steve and Jason will want to respond to some of what they're hearing from Chief Phelan and Sheriff Doherty, but let me ask Sheriff Doherty to weigh in as well. Your concerns about what you've heard from the governor's proposal?
Yeah, my concerns are in line with the chiefs, and on behalf of the state sheriffs, we've taken a similar position as the Chiefs Association. And yes, we're concerned about overall public safety. That's our jobs as law enforcement, is to worry about our communities and keep them as safe as possible. We do not see any part of legalization that's going to make anybody safer. In fact, we feel that we're going to have more issues to deal with in an already complicated system. And with marijuana legalization, I'll echo the chief on the traffic safety is probably the number one concern, but also rising crime rates, looking at states like Colorado, that probably is the best study given the time frame that they've had legalization.
Okay. Do you, Sheriff Doherty and Chief Phelan, do you expect this proposal or some variation of it to pass at this point?
My opinion would be yes.
Just given the makeup of the legislature, right?
That's correct. Given the recent months' change in the structure, and who's in charge, really, I do. Our hope at the state sheriffs are that we get our message out. It's not to say later we told you so, but our hope is that the brakes are put on, that there are more studies done, and at least a good conversation is had.
Okay. Let me ask Jason and Steve if they want to respond to some of what you heard there. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So I'm glad we looked at Colorado, because I actually just pulled some of their data from the Colorado Department of Public Safety. This was issued in October of 2018. And one of the things that they show is that the quantity of cases filed for serious marijuana-related crimes has remained consistent with pre-legalization levels. And though organized crime cases have generally increased, this has been the increase since 2008. So legalization didn't buck the trend that was already happening. In addition, we have data that shows that in the 2-year time period between Washington state legalizing and Oregon legalizing, we actually see a decrease in property crimes in Washington state as opposed to Oregon. Moreover, we have FBI data that shows that in Washington and Colorado, more cases are closed for property crime clearance rates. The clearance rates have actually increased for property crimes. And for violent crime clearance rates, they were initially declining. After legalization, we've seen that stabilize. So what we're seeing is police are actually able to solve violent crimes and property crimes. And we see at least the same trend. We don't see an increase in overall crime rates.
Okay, and in a moment I'll turn over to the sheriff and the chief to respond to that, but I do want you to at least hit part of their concern, because top of the list is traffic concerns. And what I have seen is conflicting data, but certainly, I guess just intuitively, if you have a society where no one is ever impaired by alcohol, by harder drugs, by marijuana, then you would be less concerned about people being impaired, maybe being tired. But every time that people are ingesting something that could impair you, you're going to have some non-zero number, would you not?
I mean, right.
So what do you think is realistic? What's actually happening from what you've seen both in the data and what should be acceptable to a society when it comes to sort of just freedom and understanding consequences?
So I think, first, the data shows that there's only a slight uptick in consumption rates after legalization. Some data shows that it's only 1.2%.
1.2% of people in that population going to consume who didn't consume before.
Correct.
Okay.
Specifically, Colorado, some of the data coming out of Colorado is a little distorted sometimes, because we have to remember that unlike alcohol, which is present in the blood for maybe a few hours, cannabis can be present in the blood for 6 weeks. So when we say they've detected THC, that's relatively a meaningless term, because somebody who, I think we can all agree, somebody who consumed THC 6 weeks ago is not ability impaired today. So we really
you
have...
You mean if the last time they...
Yes,
okay,
yes.
If the last time they ingested was 6 weeks ago or 6 days ago or whatever the case may be.
Right. Okay. And we have studies that show that the ability impairment lasts about 5 hours maximum. And those are coming out of Canada.
So number one, the data on who is impaired is flawed because of how long the drug stays in your system.
Right.
It's hard to get a real picture on that.
Right.
But would you accept that it's a non-zero number of people who are going to be impaired?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think we're all on the same page that we don't want anybody consuming and driving while they're ability impaired. I think that can be universally agreed upon, just the same as we don't accept that with alcohol. We shouldn't accept that with cannabis. The Colorado data does show that right here, the percentage of citations with marijuana-only impairment has stayed steady at around 7%, and that's from 2012 through 2017. So we see that they're not issuing more citations. While there may be more people, what they have done is increase the amount of times they're testing in fatal car accidents. They're testing about 3 times the amount. So if we test more, we're going to get more positive hits.
Okay. Let me ask the sheriff and the chief if they want to respond to some of that there. Go ahead, chief.
Yeah, that's partially true. And that's part of the problem is that there's not agreement among scientists as to what establishes impairment with cannabis. What amount of cannabis in your system or THC establishes impairment. There's no agreement on it. There's no consensus on it. you know, Colorado has adopted the system of testing for 5 nanograms per milliliter of blood. That's what they've established as their legal level of impairment. Is that accurate? I don't think anybody knows. You know, it might be, but we don't have an accurate method to test for THC impairment anywhere in the United States. It doesn't exist. We've had 30 years of scientific research into impairment by alcohol. We don't have that research with cannabis, so we're not prepared in any way, shape, or form to deal with this.
Do you think we should not have legalization at this level until we have research that tells us what impairment actually is?
I do. I think that situation alone shows that it's a little premature, that we should establish what constitutes impaired driving by cannabis use or marijuana use.
Okay.
We don't know that today, and we don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the ability to test and investigate these cases. Nowhere in New York do we have that ability.
Sheriff Doherty, do you agree?
I do, and Jason gave a lot of statistical data, so let me give a little response to as in his order. He talked about the crime rates in Colorado. Our state sheriff's study bases it on the Colorado Bureau of Investigation in 2017, and it cites their crime rates rising, increasing 11 times faster than the rest of the nation since legalization, with 8.3% increasing in property crimes and an 18.6% increase in violent crimes. So we do have concerns about the crime rates, what's driving that post-legalization. As far as the 1.2% that Jason cited on the scale of who will actually use and who won't post-legalization, I'm not disagreeing with that. I don't know what study that is, but I think we would all agree that once it is a societal norm that legalization of marijuana is acceptable, then it is going to maybe initially be a small percent, but as time goes on and our children believe and are pressured in schools that marijuana is okay, we are going to see a bigger increase just by societal norms. Right now, we have a lot of folks who smoke weed in their basement or behind closed doors. We know that in law enforcement. We don't actively pursue it per se. Most of our marijuana comes from a traffic stop or larger scale operations, but we do worry about the societal norm. And then lastly, on the driving, again, a study by Colorado showed 69% of self-described marijuana users admit to driving after smoking. And that is concerning. I agree with Jason that there is this time that marijuana stays in your system. And if you smoked yesterday and then you drive today, could that be in the data for a fatal crash or an arrest? Yes. Many labs don't test what is the active THC. They're just testing is there marijuana in your blood or not. And then it comes down to the police officer making the arrest that said you were impaired and you fight that in court, etc. But when you look at nearly 70% are saying that they smoke and then drive, you got to understand from law enforcement's position, from being the position of sheriff, it's deeply troubling.
Okay, and just before I kick it back to the other side of the table, just to make sure I understand your concern, when you look at the data of, say, Colorado, we got some data from Colorado saying we didn't see a surge in population-level usage of marijuana after recreational legalization. Your concern, Sheriff, is that over time, that number will sort of creep up here. But we've seen cigarette smoking levels decrease over time. In fact, looking at data on cigarette smoking, and I don't know, maybe you view it differently, but according to the CDC, we've seen, you know, rather sharp declines among 18 to 24-year-olds over time, 20.9% to 16.8% from 2005 to 2014 alone. And by 2020, below 12%. So we've seen cigarette smoking go down over time. Why would we potentially not see marijuana usage?
Well, I find it ironic that our government, our state, federal, they've pushed not to smoke. Tobacco's bad. They've told kids, don't smoke. It used to be the Marlboro Man, and now it's everything that of a dying person on our commercials saying, don't do this. So I think it makes sense that less people are smoking. But when you have government now pushing,
they've taxed it. Really, the taxes probably has just as much to do with anything as the ads.
And it may, but I think they're trying to educate on what the effects of tobacco smoking does to the consumer. And I think that's pushed down through generations. So a lot of the younger generations are not smoking. Just the opposite with this. Now you have government saying, smoke marijuana. It's okay. We're going to try and legalize it. And to your point, I think they're going to legalize it. So I wonder, are they going to have commercials to advertise the sales? Again, my concern is the societal norm that it creates.
Okay. I don't know that Governor Cuomo or others are saying smoke marijuana. I think what they might be saying is, you know, just as we don't want you to smoke cigarettes, but we're not going to make it illegal, view marijuana the same way.
So the folks who are going to be the retailers, do you believe that they will advertise?
No, I think they're going to want to make money.
Right.
I think you're right about that.
Right. So they're going to, like any business, they're going to advertise and try and attract people to smoke.
Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made there for sure. Okay, go ahead, guys.
So I just wanted to respond to a couple of things. For the advertisement, we see out in Colorado, they are virtually not allowed to advertise. There is almost no advertisement.
Is that a legal situation, though? I mean, you're saying they're not allowed to advertise.
Correct.
So the government has set limits on what you're allowed to say or do in terms of advertising the product.
Correct. The most of their advertisement out there actually ends up being people in the streets approaching people and saying, handing them a flyer saying, have you heard? There's nothing in print. There's nothing on TV. In terms of youth statistics, we actually see that in Colorado, they've actually gone down. In 2015-2016, youth marijuana rates are the lowest since they've been since 2007 and 2008. So you're talking years after legalization, we see that the rates are declining. In fact, the proportion of high school students using marijuana between 2005 and 2017 have been unchanged. So we see that it actually, when you normalize, it becomes less of an issue with the youth. If you think about alcohol versus cannabis, it's much easier to get cannabis in a school than it is to get alcohol. Alcohol, you need somebody 21 or over to go buy it from you. Cannabis, a drug dealer is going to hand you it in the hallway. So we actually see it that it's harder to get for the youth than it is, or it's harder to get when it's legalized because of its regulation.
Now, what about Sheriff Phelan's concern? And I think law enforcement in general, I think he speaks for a lot of the concern I hear from law enforcement that we don't have a BAC. We don't have an easy number that's universally agreed upon. And without that, how can you ask his department? How can you ask the sheriff's departments to regulate when we don't have an agreed upon standard?
Right. I absolutely agree that we need an objective standard. But right now, all we have is an objective standard is the alcohol BAC level. But we have a lot of other drugs that ability impair you. Opioid epidemic right now, it's illegal for me to pop a bunch of opioids and start driving around. Xanax, Ambien, you know, we can name tons of different drugs that ability impaired. And I think that, you know, we are relying on law enforcement right now to have that subjective ability. But I am working with companies, and there are companies out there that are trying to establish that objective criteria that could not only be used for cannabis, but across the board as what is objectively ability impaired.
All right. So I want to do a couple things here because our phone lines have lit up and people on all sides of this want to weigh in. And in our second half hour, we're just going to take calls and we'll let everyone respond to that. I want to ask law enforcement because, you know, they're dealing with drug enforcement. I mean, that these are the members of our community who have to do this. And I'm wondering, you know, what they feel like is possible when it comes to the so-called gateway drugs. Now, Robert DuPont is the past president of the Institute for Behavior and Health and wrote a piece for the New York Times that a lot of people have cited in which he said marijuana use is positively correlated with alcohol use and cigarette use, as well as illegal drugs like heavier drugs, cocaine, methamphetamine, et cetera. Vox.com provided an analysis saying that it is true that marijuana use correlates with harder drug use, but so does alcohol and tobacco. Correlation is not necessarily causation. And what they point to, and I'll start with Chief Phelan on this, they ask the question, could legalizing marijuana recreationally create an anti-gateway effect? They point to drug policy experts John Calkins, Bo Clymer, and Mark Kleiman, who released a new book called Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know in 2016. And they write, it's possible that people may be exposed to harder drugs when they, for example, interact with their pot dealer. So once that dealer knows a marijuana user is a reliable customer, they might push that customer to try something like heroin or cocaine. The idea being, once you're not going to a dealer for pot, that you might be able to go to a store and not have to look for a dealer illicitly, you're not going to encounter heroin, cocaine. And Vox says, to be fair, the evidence for this continues to be thin, but it's an idea that a lot of people have about one possible anti-gateway effect. Do you buy it?
No, I think the science is not there. You know, you could bring in four experts on that topic right now, and you'd probably get four different opinions. there are contradictory opinions on what you, exactly what you're talking about. It may be true. It may not be true. We don't know. I can tell you that, you know, as we were making drug arrests out on the street, you know, it's very, very common to arrest people with marijuana and opioids, marijuana and fentanyl, marijuana and heroin, marijuana, heroin, and guns. That's a weekly occurrence. So, you know, we're seeing a correlation on the street between hard drugs and marijuana and guns.
Yeah, I'm I hear what you're saying there. My mind, because I am not very well, I struggled at math growing up. So I, you know, stats is a problem for me. The same people who have, and I'm not trying to make light of this, I'm trying to be, I'm honestly try to understand the point. Heroin, fentanyl, guns, they've probably also had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, which are not, you know, there's not causation necessarily there. What you seem to see is there is some sort of causation when you start with marijuana to get there. Yes?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, Sheriff, and Sheriff, you're nodding, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of addicts. When I started on this job, I was a patrol deputy and then a drug interdiction deputy on the interstate and then an investigator. I've talked to, I don't know, hundreds if not thousands of addicts during my career. And the large majority of them will always, I don't believe I've ever talked to an addict that's hooked on heroin or crack or some harder drug that hasn't smoked marijuana. To your point, could they have all eaten peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? Yes. But when you have a conversation, the large majority, not all of them, will say it started with marijuana and that they do have some causation to blame marijuana.
Okay. And the CDC and the National Institute on Drug Abuse points out two things at the same time. The majority of marijuana users in this country do not go on to harder drug use, but they both think more research is needed to definitively say whether they think there's a gateway effect. What do you guys say on that?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the science behind, you know, endocannabinoid health and cannabis, and especially when it comes to the gateway theory. You know, historically, the gateway drug theory has been a big, has been a large platform for opposition, but as we can see with research in endocannabinoid health, you know, just like we have a digestive system, a reproductive system, a circulatory system, we also have a very robust biochemical signaling system in our body called the endocannabinoid system. And what we know from the research that's happened, primarily research that's happened overseas in places like Israel, we can see by way that the way that cannabinoids interact with this system, primarily cannabinoids like CBD, are actually causing a bit of a substitution effect. So people that are using alcohol, harder drugs, tobacco, not only are we seeing a substitution effect from these harder substances to things like cannabis, but we're also seeing a bit of an exit drug phenomenon because of the way that CBD and other cannabinoids interact. They interact with the very similar receptors that are a cause for those things like the impulsivity of addiction. And with the research that we've seen now, things like CBD can actually mitigate that impulsivity of addiction. So right now, with the very little science that we do see, and remember, it's very hard to study Schedule I drugs. So with the little research that we see, we're already seeing profound research saying that cannabis, CBD specifically, can actually be used as an exit drug.
So why do you think, Steve, law enforcement is so strongly speaking against this proposal?
I truly believe that there's just a huge education gap in this industry. You know, we go back to the 1930s and we start, you know, hearing things like reefer madness, and it's been, you know, historically an incriminating industry. But as the industry develops and we start, you know, not only seeing the millions of anecdotal testimonies and the science start to surface, we're starting to see that most of the things and the myths that we've seen have been scientifically debunked. You know, so I think it's really just a matter of having productive conversations with these, you know, being able to have, you know, we're always going to, you know, have different viewpoints, and we're always going to have opposition, especially in controversial industries like this. But if we can come to the table and have, you know, the two notoriously conflicting industries, law enforcement and the cannabis activists, actually sit down and have a conversation and say, I see your viewpoint and I understand why, but here's some more modern evidence to maybe suggest otherwise, I truly believe that it's just an education gap.
But you hear the chief saying they arrest people who have heroin, fentanyl, marijuana, sometimes guns. His concern is he sees a connection.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have my hand in law enforcement, and what we see and what we deal with on a daily basis is very different from what they deal with on a daily basis. And we want to figure out, rather than, you know, continuing this prohibition era and continuing to put, you know, keep this plant out of our system, how can we create a productive solution-based problem to this? You know, because just like we all have the same mission, we want to create a community that where our citizens are safe, where they are healthy, and they are happy. And I truly believe by putting both of our expertises on the table, we can create a very smart, very productive solution.
Last point for both sides to hit on, and then we're just going to take your feedback, which is all over the place on this issue here. One thing that we haven't really touched on much here, and I know that really matters to your cause, which is from Rock Normal, is the justice issue. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that is the single most important issue in our platform. And the reason is because historically, people of color and minority communities have been disproportionately targeted, and these communities have been devastated by the war on drugs. You know, we look at, you know, last year alone in Rochester, there were 97 arrests made for low-level marijuana crimes, and 98% of those were people of color. What bothers me most, especially as an entrepreneur, is that there's people like me that look a lot like me and look a lot like the people that are sitting at this table that are profiting and making millions of dollars off this industry, while there's people sitting behind bars that don't look a lot like us, whose families have been torn apart, whose communities have been torn apart, whose lives have been torn apart, all for doing the exact same things that we're all enjoying and, you know, conversing about today.
So can you create a system in which the economic benefits of legalization of recreational cannabis would go to communities that have been most impacted by past law enforcement?
Yes, we truly believe that with, you know, especially with the MRTA, which I mentioned earlier in the conversation, is that we see things like prioritized licenses, giving licenses to people who have been, you know, incarcerated or hurt by this industry, or minorities, women, veterans, people that have been kind of left out of this industry or burned by this industry, giving them first access. Because a lot of the people that have been hurt by this industry are the experts. So how can we create a system that we can also help people, you know, transition from the criminal justice system back into society and help them reacclimate into this industry? And we look at things like creating incubators and creating local community organizations where we can help people, you know, reacclimate into this industry with education, with tools, with human resources that can help them not only, you know, enhance their skills, but build a profitable business and really build equity and inclusivity into this industry.
Chief Phelan, Sheriff Doherty, do you agree that law enforcement of marijuana has disproportionately targeted communities of color? Chief Phelan?
No, I do not. I don't think that's accurate. You know, first of all, when we say low-level marijuana offenses, I don't know what that means. You know, if you have a small amount of marijuana in the state of New York, it's an unlawful possession of marijuana, which is a ticket. It's the same level offense as going through a stop sign. You get a ticket and you go on your way. If you have a slightly larger amount of marijuana, that's a misdemeanor offense. People don't go to jail, in at least not in Monroe County, for misdemeanor marijuana offenses. So I don't know what – I've heard the politicians in New York use the same terminology. I don't know what they mean when they say low-level marijuana offenses, but I don't see that happening. I don't see people going to jail for low-level marijuana offenses.
Sheriff Doherty.
Yeah, I'd agree. When I think of low level, I think of a UPM, unlawful possession of marijuana, which is a violation. I don't know anybody going to jail on those. I can tell you in Livingston County, we police fairly and impartially, and it's not about gender or race or political views. If you follow the rules and follow the laws, you never have a problem. You can't get arrested for marijuana possession if you don't possess marijuana. So any of the laws that pertain, I don't care if it's heroin or cocaine, if you don't possess it, you won't get arrested for it.
Okay.
One thing that I would kind of like to touch on that you had touched on earlier of kind of statistics, correlation versus causation, is we have to remember that it's not the people in this room necessarily that we're talking about. It's at a statewide or national scale. So while, you know, your departments in particular may not have any issues whatsoever, there are clearly departments out there that do. I mean, we have the data to show that minority.
Chief is shaking his head. You don't believe it.
I don't. I don't think that. I don't think those statistics necessarily prove that there's disproportionate enforcement. There may be disproportionate violation of the law.
We actually know that that's not true. We know that studies have shown that whites and minority communities smoke at the exact same rates. But you're 10 times more likely to go to jail if you're a minority for a drug-related offense. Now, that could be tacked on to an additional offense. As they were talking about UPMs, are a violation. Problem being is, as soon as it comes out into public, it's no longer a violation. So you've now raised the criminality, because if you bring it out into public, that's a higher offense. So
if you bring marijuana out into public?
Yes.
Yeah, so if you smoke it in public, if you're using it in public, it's a misdemeanor, which once again, misdemeanors are not high-level crimes, and so people are not going to jail for misdemeanors.
Misdemeanors are punishable by up to a year in jail. The
sheriff are saying no one's going to jail for that.
I mean, we can talk to the 97 people that were arrested last year for it and find out what happened to them. But, I mean, people are going to jail. 800,000 people since, do you remember this year? I can't remember the year, but in New York, 800,000 people have been incarcerated for marijuana, and I think it's either since 2000 or 2010. I can't remember which date.
Okay. I think, Chief Phelan, you seem to at least be disputing that would just be for marijuana possession or smoking in public at a misdemeanor level.
I don't. Yeah, and if there's a problem with that, then fix the problem. I mean, I think you can fix that problem if it exists without completely legalizing marijuana. If there's a regional problem, fix the regional problem. If people are in a certain region of New York are going to jail for misdemeanor marijuana offense, I agree with you. I don't want people sitting in jail for misdemeanor marijuana offense. Fix the problem.
How do we do that?
But widespread. The state of New York can enact any law it wants. You know, I mean, I think the bail reform law itself, the proposed bail reform legislation, would solve that problem. Not that I agree with that.
All right. Well, we're late for our only break of the hour. You're hearing Chief Patrick Phelan of the Grease Police Department and Sheriff Tom Doherty of Livingston County. They are here with us in studio. You just heard Jason Klimek, a legal advisor for Rock Normal, and Steve VanDeWalt, the deputy chief of Rock Normal. That's the Rochester chapter for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. They would like to see recreational legalization and decriminalization of cannabis in New York State, which Governor Cuomo is proposing. Law enforcement, largely speaking, is very much against that for a number of reasons that they have been describing this hour. Let's get your feedback on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with the leader of a San Francisco-based company called Employee Channel that had to make a decision. They wanted to expand outside of San Francisco. They looked at Portland and Dallas and Pittsburgh, which is big for tech, and Toronto. But they ultimately chose Rochester. And last spring, they expanded to Rochester. Why? How did Rochester win that little battle? We'll talk about that and the implications next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's hit a couple of questions from our listeners. In fact, let's get through as much of your feedback as we can before the end of the hour here. Jim and Irondequoit first. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, I'd just like to know if the law enforcement personnel also support prohibition of alcohol.
You want to know if law enforcement personnel support prohibition of alcohol?
Yes, every time we have these conversations about the legalization of marijuana, we have these discussions of one side and the other, but I never hear law enforcement come out against the legalization of alcohol, the continuation of it, and I don't understand why that never gets discussed when we can easily prove the dangers of that.
Okay, Jim, thank you. Chief Phelan, you want to see alcohol made illegal?
You know, I think conflating those two issues is disingenuous, and it's not really productive to the argument. I mean, if somebody wants to propose making alcohol illegal, that's certainly something we could discuss, but it's really two different issues.
Okay. Sheriff Doherty?
Yeah, I mean, alcohol is legal, and that's the laws we enforce. If alcohol was illegal at the present moment and they were talking about it legalizing that, then we would probably have a totally different statistical data to be talking about. And yes, we do have many crashes because of alcohol, and if law enforcement's going to say they don't, then they wouldn't be being genuine either. We have our hands full with alcohol-related crashes. That's our bigger concern, is that now adding this in is going to make for more crashes that are due to recreational drug use. And that is the concern, is that it's recreational.
Okay. Anything you want to add there, guys, before we go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes down to the overall, safety of the public and public health is that we have to look at all things that are affecting public health. Obviously, cannabis is the main topic of conversation and alcohol is the close second. But what about things like promoting, you know, refined carbohydrates and sugary cereals to our kids, things that we know is fueling the childhood obesity problem? You know, all these things that we forget that have substantial and scientifically proven damaging health benefits that we're surrounded by every day, whether you walk in at Wegmans or you walk into a grocery store. So I think we realize that, you know, prohibition and keeping things out of society doesn't work. You know, we even things that we can unanimously agree on, like rape and murder and theft, things that are all universally bad and unethical, they still happen. So rather than continue to, you know, put a Band-Aid on this and continue to try to keep this out of our system, how can we figure out the best way to implement it? Because it is coming. And we want to work on the same side of the team of the people that are enforcing laws. We don't want to continue to butt heads. But that's going to involve having conversations like that and figuring out the best solution, because there's many solutions and there's a lot of data that we're pulling from. And we're starting to see that there's a lot of data inconsistencies. So we really need to focus on creating good quality data and from that creating good quality solutions.
Laurel and Canandaigua next on the phone. Go ahead, Laurel.
Yeah, hi. I'm a family doctor. I've been practicing for 32 years, and there's a couple things I want to mention. One is I have, like, no marijuana success stories in my practice, right? What it seems to do to me is make a lot of people that are, quote-unquote, potheads. And to have this panel without educators, substance abuse counselors, and physicians, I think is a mistake. Marijuana is totally different in the effects on the body than alcohol. Alcohol is water soluble. You get drunk, it's out of your system. Marijuana builds up in your fatty tissues. Your brain is made of fat. So every joint you smoke stays with you for ages. And the habitual daily use of marijuana is absolutely going to make more people with mental impairment. So we have studies showing that if pregnant women smoke pot, their children are more likely to have ADD and learning disabilities, that if older people smoke pot habitually, they're more likely to become demented. If teenagers smoke pot, they're more likely to become schizophrenic. So we're looking at creating a large number of habitual users, which we haven't had. At least 10% of those are going to have a substance abuse problem, and many of them are going to have mental disorders that we're going to have to be dealing with as a society. And I think to embark on this giant experiment without more data is crazy.
Just one quick question, Lord. So I do understand. The mental disorder that you're concerned that people will get from marijuana usage is what?
There's many. There's a study absolutely showing that teens who smoke pot are more likely to become schizophrenic or have major mental disorders. There's some other studies showing that, again, in children exposed to marijuana, they're more likely to have ADD or learning disabilities. I had a woman who's nursing her baby, surprised she shouldn't be smoking pot and nursing. This is a whole thing of the normalization of pot use. A whole bunch of people are going to think it's harmless, and it isn't even close to being harmless.
All right, Laurel, thank you very much. Go ahead, guys.
Yeah, I think the issue in question is that it's not really cannabis that's the issue, it's THC. And I will sit here and agree with a background in neuroscience that I do believe that underage and adolescent consumption of THC can have some downstream health effects. While I don't think the science is conclusive yet because there's simply not enough research, I would agree with you. But let's go back to the endocannabinoid conversation and all the other 110 cannabinoids that are found in cannabis and just forget about THC. Are you aware that our bodies already actually make two different types of cannabinoids? One of them is called 2-AG, and one of them is actually present in women's breast milk, which is something that we know has robust therapeutic effects when it comes to cognitive enhancement of youth. So I think we need to separate the industry a little bit from THC and the rest of the plant, because THC aside, we look at things like CBD and CBG and anandamide and 2-AG, all these other phytocannabinoids, endogenous cannabinoids that are proving to be incredibly beneficial when it comes to health. So yes, I think that there needs to be an extreme amount of education. There needs to be educators. There needs to be substance abuse educators.
Education for pregnant women?
There needs to be education for everybody. Our children should be learning about this just like they do in health class, just like they learn about the reproductive system. system.
Just how they learn about alcohol.
Yeah, we need to teach them. We can't just pretend that this is some reefer madness and this is some devil's lettuce drug. This is a real industry with real science and real therapeutic potential. And if we continue to just fearmonger on all the what ifs and all the the data that's a bit anecdotal at this point, we're never going to get anywhere. So we really have to focus on the plant as a whole and have a huge focus on education. So I do agree that there needs to be a huge push for education.
One listener wants to says DWI. Alcohol was illegal before there were machines to test BAC. Cops used field sobriety tests and observations. Can the same thing be done with marijuana? Chief Phelan, Sheriff Doherty?
Can we develop machines to test for
Just reading the comment again, he says alcohol was illegal before there were machines that tested for blood alcohol content, and cops used field sobriety tests and their own observations. Can that same thing be done with marijuana?
I'm sure it can. I mean, just keep in mind, it's taken us a long time to get to where we are with DWI enforcement as far as alcohol goes. And we're at a time in our history where we are very efficient at detecting and arresting people for driving under the influence of alcohol, and we do it very, very well. I think my department arrested almost 400 people last year for driving under the influence of alcohol. We do not have that science right now to detect marijuana intoxication. And it would take, I'm sure it could be developed, but it's not going to be developed by April 1st of 2020.
So just be realistic here. Just being realistic, you both expect, given the makeup of the legislature, that this will pass. And if April 1st, 2020, we're talking less than 14 months away, comes, and we don't have, machines to test for BAC, you're going to have to, I assume you have to come up with a field test, right? You got to use a field test and observations?
We already have those. We're arresting people right now for being impaired by marijuana and other drugs, even legal prescribed prescription drugs.
So you can do it.
So, yeah, we're going solely off the discretion of the deputy sheriff making the arrest. And if available, we use a DRE, called it drug recognition expert, to then give their independent expert opinion. And then we ask them to take either blood or urine, which would be kind of similar to taking a breath test. If you refuse, you have your license revoked by a judge and it's considered a refusal. But if we do get that, then it goes to the lab and then they give us what they can out of it. I think the more challenging are two issues. One, we don't have a roadside test similar to like a pre-screen. At least not one that I've heard of, and I'm sure that not one has passed a Frey hearing, which is the scientific instrument in a court of law. And then second, what is the THC? What's the active THC? And I think it's going to take several months, if not years, to determine what is that appropriate amount. And I don't hear many people talking about that. And I hope that, like, we're having an adult conversation today.
Yeah.
We may have different points of view. But they need to get health experts in the room. They need to get law enforcement in the room. They need to get advocates on the side of legalization like we have here today and have an adult conversation about it. Mm-hmm.
By the way, David says, does law enforcement fear their budgets will be impacted negatively if marijuana is decriminalized?
I always laugh at that because they think like our budget, like we take some revenue from making a UPM arrest or whatever. It will be, if his question is like, are we going to lose money in our pockets? The answer is no. If he's asking if our budgets are going to be hurt in a negative way, then yes, because we're going to need more DREs. We're going to need more deputies that are proficient in field sobriety tests. Our canine out on the road, they're all certified. In Livingston County alone, we have three narcotics dogs, and what will the future for them look like? If they're certified to sniff marijuana and now it's legalized, what is the negative when they hit on something and it's fought in a court of law? So many are talking about retiring their canines if this is legalized. One dog may have $20,000 or $30,000 worth of training.
You want to hit that real quick, and then we're going to get back to your phone calls.
Yeah, I just had one question. I'm assuming that those dogs also recognize other drugs, correct? They're not solely...
That's
marijuana?
Correct, but where if I sniffed it out, I could say, hey, I smell this. A dog can't tell you what they're sniffing, so their alert is all one. So they might be alerting on heroin. They may be alerting on marijuana. And in the case law I've seen, not from here, the judge ruled that the dog didn't know what it's alerting on. So how did you know that it was this and not that? And again, that has law enforcement have a discussion and go, how are we going to combat this? How can we keep our active dogs in service and be accountable to the taxpayers and not have to spend exorbitant amounts of money to get dogs, new dogs, because you can't retrain these dogs. It just doesn't work that way.
You can't unteach them to smell
That's
marijuana,
correct.
I'm assuming, right?
That's correct.
Betsy in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Betsy.
Hi. I agree with both components of both people. I think that there should be decriminalization of marijuana so that we're not filling the jails with young people, because it is a fact that the war on drugs has targeted the inner city minority population. But I also believe that the police have very valid concerns in maintaining public safety, and that I'm so glad that the doctor called in, because that is a very, very valid component also. My big fear is that you're not discussing about is the fact that big money is already working on capitalizing on this industry. They've already manipulated in the Juul component with cigarettes, and they are very ready and financially able to jump into this market. And so even though the proponent for giving these jobs to inner city people who were already involved in marijuana trading, they are going to be blown out of the water by people who have very deep pockets. And once big money gets into it, there is no way to get them out. And as we can already see by how they've affected our society overall, I think it just opens up a big ball of wax. And so right now, I agree with the police and this other gentleman that we need to have these discussions really thoroughly with people who have information, so that all of this gets worked out before they institute it. I think it's foolish to institute it without further research.
Well, thank you, Betsy. I think that's one of the reasons we're trying to have conversations like this, where we've got people who disagree clearly, but they want to at least have a substantive discussion on what it means, because it does look like it's coming. I think the law enforcement officers on the program today are making a good point. The governor's got the political numbers to get this done in the next year. So the question becomes, what does it look like in practice? And there's something that Keith says. Keith says we're ignoring one part of this whole discussion. What is that, Keith?
The edible part of the market. You don't have to smoke a joint to get the effects of THC. And everybody will be able to witness this come April 1st, because that's when Canada will allow edibles in the market. They're having a hard time right now just keeping up with smokable marijuana, and they're adding edibles. Now, I've spent some time in the last 6 months in Denver, and I've gone into the dispensary just out of basic curiosity, and they have more shelf space dedicated to edibles, from high-end chocolate bars to hard candy to suckers to whatever you can imagine. And from experience of being in there, you see every type of person in there, from the grandmother to the person who you would look at and you would assume they're smoking weed, to people just like you and me. So I think eventually it's going to segue into more edibles, because smoking is unhealthy.
All right, Keith, thank you. What are you making, a sandwich in there? Don't stop what you're doing, man. Are we ignoring edibles?
No, I think that we do have to have the conversation outside of smoking, because, you know, there's a million different ways to consume cannabis, whether it's through traditional flower or edibles or creams and salves and lollipops. I think the matter is having a regulated market where we can actually open a package or like a brownie, and if it says you're getting 20 milligrams of THC, you're getting 20 milligrams of THC. You know, you buy an edible off the illicit market now that says it's 20 milligrams in THC, and it could be in the very first bite. It could also maybe have 60 milligrams. So that's why establishing a strong regulatory framework with proper packaging and labeling and child safety hazards, where we can say, you know, be sure that what we're getting on the shelves is actually what we're ingesting.
You guys worried about edibles?
Yeah, all
the above.
All of the above.
Yeah, okay. we're seeing the use of edibles already, because you can buy them in other places and bring them here. So, and what you are seeing with edibles is people using way too much marijuana because they don't know how much they're getting in a brownie or a piece of candy. We're also recovering edibles from our schools.
Two more quick comments, real quick in the last minute. Arthur says there does need to be more cannabis research, and that can't be done adequately until marijuana is removed from Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. It should be reclassified. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Really quickly, too, Governor Cuomo's CRTA actually has a research license built into it, so it will be using state funds until the federal illegality ends.
Okay, remove it from Schedule 1?
I'm not a proponent of that till the research is done.
Okay.
No.
Same. Rich wants to know, he says, if marijuana is legalized, can businesses, hospitals, corporations, school bus drivers, and companies test and fire individuals who test positive for cannabis? As an example, I wouldn't want a surgeon who smokes marijuana operating on me, from Rich. What do you think?
Well, you have the same problem. I mean, you can't go to work drunk, right? So, I mean, but the problem with marijuana is how much marijuana in your system constitutes impairment. Once again, we don't know.
Okay.
Under the law, under the proposed laws, what we're seeing is that you would be protected from being fired merely for the presence of THC. And it would be just like Chief said.
They would have to rise to a level your employer would prove that you are impaired.
Exactly.
They can't just terminate you if you have THC in your
Correct.
System.
Correct.
Okay. Law enforcement largely against this proposal. What do you want people to do in the intervening months and weeks here of the session here? You want people to get in touch with the lawmakers?
Absolutely. Have conversations with them, and let's try and slow this lightning train down. We didn't talk much about the revenue, but people are constantly saying to me, we need that revenue in New York State. The projections were $83 million for the first year, and then going to $184 million thereafter. That's 0.1% of the state budget. So don't think this is going to solve all your taxation problems.
And Rock Normal online, where to get more information?
Rocknormal.org. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Get a hold of us. We're a really great resource.
Thanks to all of you for the conversation. Short break, more connections.